Good morning, Los Angeles, and welcome to another edition of the Weekend Warrior Show. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Clapper. I'm an orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai, 31 years. Wow. I'm so excited for today's show. My guest in studio is world-renowned hand surgeon, Dr. Steve Shin. Any elite athlete with a hand injury ends up seeing him. He's the surgeon, and I can say this because it's been in the news, for Chris Paul, Mike Trout, Drew Brees, Steph Curry. His mind never stops, as he's also a talented inventor, just like me. We're talking about understanding this most complicated part of our body, the hand. His tools and new surgical ideas have made our world a better place, and it made me think all week about the world of hands and the delicate surgery we do on these tiny complex structures that allows us to grip, grasp, and even type into your phone. Where in art, in sports, and in medicine do we see the power and expressiveness of our fingers and palms? I can't wait to talk about this. In art, the painter Renoir was key in the revolution about bringing the whole idea of impressionism with his buddy Claude Monet in the 1880s. As photography started to threaten the portrait painter, why do you need to have a painting painted of someone when you can take a picture? So these guys came up with the idea of, let's do something the photographers can't do, which is make blotches of paint that from a distance look exactly like the portrait, but when you get up close, it's just a bunch of globs of color, impressionism. But Renoir got rheumatoid arthritis, one of the most crippling diseases you can get to joints, and it particularly destroys the fingers and the hands. How do we know Renoir got rheumatoid arthritis? Well, it's because when you look at his paintings, his portraits, early in his career, they're beautiful. They're perfect. But a painter cannot help but look at their own fingers when they're painting the model as a guide. And what you see after 1888, as the disease takes over in his body, look at the fingers of the women and the models in his paintings, and they have all the hand deformities of someone with rheumatoid arthritis. He couldn't help himself but to use his own hands as a guide, and we see that. So I can't wait to teach you about Renoir and his hands and the brilliance that he could use his fingers subtly to hold the paintbrush, even with the disease. And what about in sports? Where do we see the subtlety of what a hand and a finger can do, gently curving the finger and how it grips a baseball? Is the difference between the greatest pitcher, Mariano Rivera, versus all the other pitchers? There's only one guy who's been unanimous vote to the Hall of Fame, Mariano Rivera. And you're going to hear Vin Scully getting so excited as a Dodger fan when we got to see Mariano Rivera even pitch against the Dodgers. Why could he throw just one pitch, it's called a cutter, that nobody could hit and everybody knew it was coming? Why could he do it? What was it about his fingers that allowed him to throw something that nobody else could throw? And it's because Mariano Rivera grew up dirt poor. You're going to hear him talking about making a cardboard box into a baseball mitt because they couldn't afford it. And they used to wrap the fishing nets in with tape to make a baseball, go into the forest and get a stick as a bat. I mean, we're talking poor. But part of what Mariano Rivera had to do as a child was help his dad, who was a sardine fisherman in Panama, which meant he had to hold the nets to dry them out with all 10 fingers spread maximally apart since he's a kid. This led to him having fingers that were so flexible and could spread so far that when he held the baseball, he could put his fingers around the seams of the baseball like no one else. It gave him control, and it gave him consistency, and it gave him an ability to spin the ball so that it could drop 8 inches from the moment it hit the, maybe just right in front of the batter, 8 inches it would drop. They couldn't even hit the baseball. It's because of the subtleties. And I can't wait for Dr. Shin to teach us. How is that possible? It's not just the tip of your finger we're talking about. It's the side of your finger. And why is that relevant? Because he's going to teach us that the three nerves that go to the hand, the median nerve, the ulnar nerve, the radial nerve, when you get to your ring finger, it's all about halves. It's all about one half of the tip of your ring finger is the ulnar nerve. The other half is the median nerve. It's not like, okay, these two fingers are one nerve and these are the other. No. It's that subtle that it's half the finger. And I just can't wait to get into that. But let's get started with today's show. Listen to Vince Scully talking about seeing Mariano Rivera at Dodger Stadium.
Well, if there's one satisfaction to a Dodger fan tonight amidst all of the frustration, is they will get a chance to see Mariano Rivera. Mariano, 6'2", 190. He's had 19 years in the big leagues. He has 641 saves. He's been a closer since 1997. He certainly helped the Yankees win 4 World Series in 5 years.
Now let's listen to Vin Scully talk about why he's so special. Because of this one pitch called the cutter that they all know it's coming, but nobody can hit it.
The cutter, which is a fastball that breaks, they say that his cutter breaks about 8 inches. It's a remarkable pitch. Basically, it's the only pitch he throws now. And even though they know it's coming, they can't handle it.
I just want you to hear from the man himself talking about taking a cardboard box with a knife, cutting a hole in it so your hand can slip through it, and then covering the palm of your hand with the cardboard box, and that's your baseball glove. When you're in Panama and you got nothing, this is your baseball glove.
I'm going to show you right now. I use this cardboard, or kind of like this. This is my glove.
So the paper box was your glove?
Oh, that was a big glove. That was also a Smith glove, big time. Good glove. See? Put a whole cutter bar, cut the cardboard box behind there, put it there, my wrist. Here's my glove right here. Put me there. You can call the ball from anywhere. That was my glove.
That was my glove. And my ball was a bunch of fishing nets taped up. But when you have that will, when you have that drive, I had to get out of Far Rockaway. I needed to get out. For me, it wasn't baseball. It was going to Columbia. But that's the thing that you want your kids to have. Drive. And when you give them everything, you take that away from them. So be careful. The greatest blessing I ever got was coming from Far Rockaway to get out of there. The greatest blessing Mariano Rivera got was, I got to get out of Panama, and I don't want to work on a sardine boat. Listen to Drew Brees, also someone who needed surgery by Dr. Shin, talk about, it's just your finger. I'm just throwing a football. Listen to Drew Brees connect, and we call it the kinetic chain. The shoes he's wearing and how it touches the turf is actually related to the spin that will be on the football that makes him the most accurate thrower of the football of all time.
To throw the perfect pass, it's all about the kinetic chain. It's now just a matter of that rhythm of the energy being transferred from my feet, then to my hips, all the way up to my shoulders. And as my arm's coming through, the last thing to leave the ball is that index finger.
Phenomenal. The subtleties of what that index finger can do makes the difference between a ball that's in the hands of the receiver versus an interception. What about in art, the subtleties of the hand? At 7:15, we're going to talk to Dr. Steve Shin about the hand. Nobody knows it better than he does. But I just love to explore in art the subtleties of holding the paintbrush. Here's a story about Jean Renoir, the greatest impressionist painter outside of Claude Monet.
So one of the paintings that was turned down by the salons was this nude torso in the sunlight. It's a little bit irregular. It's off-center. This nude figure is coming out of the forest, and it has this impressionist, light-capturing kind of mode rather than the dramatic realism that was necessary for the acceptance of his works by the Salon, so this was turned down.
So as a realist painter, nobody's interested. Mariano Rivera started out as a shortstop. Nobody was interested in him pitching, but he persevered.
Here's what the critic said about that painting.
Listen to this.
Tried to explain to Renoir that a woman's torso is not a mass of flesh decomposing, with purple-green splotches that look like the final stages of putrefaction in a corpse.
You got to have a titanium spine to be able to say, nope, I'm still going to persevere. But here he is changing the world, painting differently than anybody ever painted before, but he's healthy. He hasn't gotten rheumatoid arthritis yet. And his paintings are about to blow everyone's mind, and it's called Impressionism.
And everybody that's been to Chicago knows On the Terrace, which is in the Art Institute of Chicago. I love this painting because it's the scientists, it's the conservators there, Mary Jean Butler and Inga Fiedler, that study all their paintings to try and conserve them. They want to know how they're made and how they're put together. And they were able to determine that in this painting, Renoir only used 7 paints. How was he able to get all those different kinds of variations of colors be painted wet into wet?
So what does wet on wet mean? It's a trick, and you got to be able to use the tips of your fingers with the brush to do this wet on wet technique. And when you get rheumatoid arthritis and you can't use your fingers, you can't even feed yourself. How is he able to make the greatest portraits in the world with this disease?
That meant he took the paintbrush and he dipped it into one color, put it on the canvas, took a different paintbrush, put it into a different color, and then mixed it while it was still wet. Now, you know where I'm going with that. Did his technique change after he developed rheumatoid arthritis? Wet into wet, beautiful painting, varied colors, only 7. So here is Madame Clapisson that Inga sent me. And if you look in the upper right-hand corner where he signed his name, you can see that the individual colors are mixed, and some you can see as individualistic, and some you can see as blended together.
You can analyze the paintings. Not only look at the fingers of the models in the paintings before 1888 when he normal hands, you start to see the changes in his technique that he has to do in order to still paint.
So since it takes several years before even a layperson can see the typical deformities of rheumatoid arthritis, maybe 1888 was the right time. Let's remember that date as the start of his rheumatoid arthritis. And so let's look at every painting after 1888. 2 girls reading, young girls at the piano. That's Edouard Manet's daughter and his goddaughter in the dark hair. And so what did he do? He took responsibility for his disease. He designed his own exercise equipments. He juggled leather balls. He played with his ball and peg game, in which you throw the ball up and it's got a little hole in it and you catch it in the peg.
And in that painting he's talking about, you see for the first time what's known as ulnar deviation, that because the joint is being destroyed, the body's attacking its own cartilage. That's what we mean by autoimmune, where your body, it's almost like, here's a clapper vision. If you get a wooden splinter, right? And I got many of those, being the son of a carpenter, lifting up, you know, plywood and whatnot with no gloves on. You get a piece of wood splinter in your hand, it's going to be rejected by your body because we're not made of wood. And you get that redness, that swelling, that horrible, like a mosquito bite, which is also foreign material into your hand. Your body reacts to it. That's what the inflammatory response is. Rheumatoid arthritis is, one day, 1888, this painter wakes up and his body has decided that the cartilage in its joints is like a wooden splinter and turns on the mechanism to reject the wooden splinter, except it's its own cartilage. It attacks itself and destroys the joints. So what happens? Your fingers start to drift. They don't stay centrally located. They start to drift. If they go one way, it's called radial deviation. If it goes the other way, it's called ulnar deviation. And you see the deformity in the fingers in Renoir's paintings.
But then in 1901, he gets a remission. And here he's painted again. But notice the swelling of his metacarpophalangeal joint in that index finger. And look at the deformity in his hands as he's still sitting in that chair. And then in 1903, he moves to the south of France to seek the better weather.
Because that's how you treat this inflammatory response. Many people move to Arizona from the northeast for the reason of the weather helping their diseases.
So I want to show you this movie of him actually painting now. Look at the ulnar deviation. Look at the paintbrush coming out in between his fingers. There is, for the people who can't see the movie that only saw a still of it, the lay literature says that he painted with the paintbrush in his hand, and he said no. He just held the paintbrush there, and you'll see that in the movie.
So he didn't tape the brushes to the back of his hand. He persisted in trying to use what he had left from the disease and still carried on and made some of the most beautiful paintings the world's ever seen.
Painted with his hands always, Sean told me. And he didn't paint with the paintbrushes strapped to his hands, as some of the modern calendars will tell you. And here he is in 1914, painting from the wheelchair, because every painting after 1912, he's class 4B. And the close-up shows that the paintbrush is coming out in between his fingers, and there's the painting. Is that not incredible?
When I do knee surgery and shoulder surgery and hip surgery, it's different. It's different than the hand surgery that Dr. Shin does because of the complexity of that structure that really has allowed us to evolve to be the human race that we are, different from the other animals. We're talking about subtle movements that make the difference between just throwing the football or throwing it like Drew Brees. And I really can't wait to get into it. Coming up next, we're going to talk to the great Dr. Steve Shin about the beautiful world of what makes up our hands. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on 710 ESPN.
Love it.
I'm going to let this music play. Understand. On a slow hand. That's what they called Eric Clapton. Slow hand. Listening to him yesterday. The more complicated the surgery, the more I listen to Eric Clapton. And he just calms the room down. I feel bad for the nurses, but they actually enjoy it. Because many surgeons don't even listen to music. But I love listening to music. And unfortunately, I just love listening to Eric Clapton. So they hear it over and over again. But that's okay. The things could be worse. I'm so excited because I'm joined in studio by my good friend, and really, I respect the hell out of him, the great Dr. Steve Shin. Steve, thanks so much for waking up early and fighting the traffic to get here.
Thanks for having me, Robbie.
So I love passion, and whether you work in a lumber yard or you're a surgeon, whatever you do for a living, that draws you, and what you have is passion for hand surgery. Where did that come from? You got exposed to pediatrics. You got exposed to spine surgery. You could do all kinds of knee surgery. What was it about hand surgery, and when was that moment, and who is the surgeon that inspired you?
That's a great question. I would say my passion for hand surgery truly began back when I was in college.
Really?
That long ago. When I was a senior in college, I did some research on a complex topic in wrist surgery with my mentor, Dr. Arnold Peter Weiss at Brown over in Rhode Island. Wow. And that's where I was in college and medical school. And he was just a great guy, but a smart guy. And the way he interacted with patients and did research, amazing. And so I was like, you know what? I want to be like him. You know, that, so I kind of knew even before medical school that hand surgery was the way I wanted to go. And then I had to choose between, all right, am I going to be a bone doc, orthopedist and do it, or am I going to be a plastic surgeon because they can both do it?
Right.
And I was like, you know what? I like putting things together. I like working with my hands. And I didn't want to do cosmetic surgery all day. So I was like, I'll do orthopedics, and did that, went to New York, did that, and eventually did a year of training in just hand surgery. And then I joined the family famous Curl and Joerber Orthopedic Clinic, and where I developed somewhat more great mentors like Dr. Frank Job, who I miss dearly, Dr. Steve Lombardo, and Clarence Shields, who you know,
right.
Dr. James Taboni. And so over a course of about 15 years at Curl and Job, I was able to develop continue to develop this passion in hand surgery, but also treating athletes.
A good friend of both of ours is Dr. Eletrash, the Dodger doctor, the Ram doctor, and he gave a lecture that I went to. I enjoyed so much because I still see you and him as artists in addition to being great surgeons. And in this lecture, and this show is called The Weekend Warrior, it's about the people who watch sports when we play on the weekends, but the real warriors are the professional athletes. And the injuries are the same, right? Our bodies are the same. Many of the surgeries, not all of the surgeries, are the same. But what I learned in this lecture that Dr. Eletrash gave was, in order for our bodies to throw a baseball at 100 miles an hour, you're asking the ligaments, the tendons, the muscles, the cartilage, the joint to do something that actually is supernatural. So be careful, Dr. Eletrash said to the audience of orthopedic surgeons, when you see a labral tear in an elite athlete's shoulder, when you see a capsular rip in an elite baseball player's shoulder, your temptation will be, I got to put stitches, I got to repair it, I got to make it right. But actually, he may have accommodated his body and rip the hell out of the labrum and the capsule to get the torque and the speed so that he can throw 100 miles an hour. And that, in fact, if you repair it, he won't be able to do that anymore. When we listen to the subtleties of Mariano Rivera's cutter pitch that no one else can throw, or Drew Brees with an accuracy with a football that no one else has, and the elite athletes that you get to take care of for their hands, do you see similarities that they've had to accommodate their anatomy to allow them to become elite?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And Dr. Eletrash, a dear friend of mine and a brilliant, brilliant guy, he taught me a lot of this and taught me how to focus on the whole individual, and not just one body part. So even though I'm a hand and wrist surgeon, you know, and as you mentioned before, the kinetic chain from the toes all the way to the fingertips, it's so true. And these athletes have to, learn how to push their body to the max, to be able to do what they do. It's almost unhuman, kind of what they do. But it's absolutely true. They need to accommodate, their bodies for the specific activity, whether it's throwing a baseball, throwing that cutter that you just talked about by Mariano Rivera, or the football, you know, being able to get that space between your thumb and your fingers to grip that football like Drew Brees, or basketball, whatever the sport, whatever the thing that you are that you're gripping. I think that, these players, these elite athletes really have to learn how to accommodate their bodies for their activity.
I know listening now is a friend of mine, Reinhold Schmieding, who's really developed a company that we're all very proud of, who are surgeons, because he actually listens to what we need in the operating room, and the company is Arthrex. And you are very involved with Arthrex in the design, and as I said in the introduction, about making the world a better place, moving the needle, getting people to have an injury and get back on the field, back to work. It doesn't necessarily have to be an elite athlete. And your fascination with what's known as an internal brace, which you're a real leader in the design and the development and bringing this cool new gadget to our world. I want to ask you, there's a difference, and we see football players tearing their ACLs all the time, and everybody knows, up, they're out for the season, because we have to now use, I don't like the cadaver as a graft, I prefer to use the athlete's own structures and just rearrange the furniture in the knee, but I'm going to use something different to rebuild their ligament versus actually putting stitches in it. The synovial fluid doesn't let the ACL heal on its own like a ligament to the MCL or other areas. So you need surgery and you have to use a graft. the beautiful new world of repairing the ACL, but it's really only for a select few in terms of the location of the tear. So we're not there yet. But the idea of repairing what's torn versus having to use a graft or some other body part, some other piece of furniture to make up for the fact that the living room chair is gone, so now you use a kitchen chair or whatever. That's basically what a graft is. That internal brace is now allowing you to use the patient's own ligament rather than a graft. Talk to me more about why you prefer to repair something versus reconstruct it.
Sure. It's a great question, and it's one of my passions within my passion, actually, right now, is studying this concept called an internal brace augmentation of a ligament repair. So you're not replacing the ligament, at least we're not yet, with something synthetic. We're trying to improve the strength of your repair and not have to use another tissue graft, like a tendon or something, to replace the ligament that's torn. And so this internal brace that we call it really acts like a seatbelt. And that's what Reinhold and Arthrex continuously say. And that's what we want to get across is that when you're stressing that ligament right before the point of failure, okay, right before that ligament just wants to bust open again, you've got this seatbelt, this internal brace that kicks in. And so it's not going to take away from the strength of the healing of the ligament while it's healing. You don't want it to do that. You want it to just kick in at the right time. And so that's what gives me the confidence when I do this procedure, for example, for a thumb ulnar collateral ligament injury. So there's a different UCL from the more famous UCL on the elbow that where Tommy John surgery is done if that's ruptured. So there's a smaller one in the thumb, and that's what Drew had torn.
And Mike Trout and Chris Paul and all the other people you've taken care of.
Sure,
I love
it. Sure, a few more. So I was thinking, you know what? This and first of all, I didn't invent this procedure. This was another brilliant guy in Scotland, Dr. Gordon McKay, came up with this concept with Arthrex, using it for ankle instability and trying to repair a ligament down there and try to get the with the internal brace and get these athletes back to walking, running, jumping much, much sooner. And he was able to do that. So I was thinking, wow, it's working great in this weight bearing joint. Surely we can use it in the thumb for this very common injury. So I started doing it there and so refining the technique over time. And obviously Arthrex they're the only company that offers the unique implants to do this internal brace augmentation. And they were very receptive to surgeon feedback and allowed me to give input to the design as well as the techniques and finally came up with that perfect technique to use the internal brace for this thumb UCL tear. It gives me the confidence to get the patients moving faster, getting them back to play faster. And it's not just athletes, by the way. It's not just athletes that get these injuries, obviously. It's called skier's thumb. So people who ski get it too. But it's also, someone who falls on the sidewalk, and hyperextends their thumb or gets it caught on something and the thumb goes a different way and tears a ligament. And so anybody can get it. So anybody that doesn't, want to be in a cast after surgery, and traditionally you have to be for at least a month, maybe 6 weeks, they don't have to be anymore. They can get moving within 2 or 3 days, which is what these elite athletes have done. So it's been really amazing.
I'm going to have to take a break, but when we come back, I tell the listeners, I see God in my life in two places. One, when I surf and a porpoise comes up next to me while I'm in the ocean, it just brings me back to who started this whole thing. And I see God in the operating room. And one of the most fascinating muscles in the body, I actually don't deal with, but you do. Because a muscle is anchored to bone, crosses the joint, and allows us to move our elbow, our shoulder, our knee. It crosses the joint as a tendon, causes the movement. But there's one area of the body where the muscle actually doesn't originate from the bone. It originates from another muscle, the lumbricus. When you see a lumbricus, it makes you weep. It makes you appreciate who invented this. And I want to talk about that and a few other things. Coming up next with the great Dr. Steve Shin. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors show here on 710 ESPN. The Rolling Stones! We're playing She's Under My Thumb! has come. She's under my thumb. You know what's under your thumb? The nail bed. There's the tip of the nail, and there's actually the germinal center of the nail. As my dad, the carpenter, used to say when I swung the hammer, helping him when I was 10 years old. And Robbie, he used to say, don't forget, don't hit the wrong nail. Meaning hit the metal nail, not the nail on your finger. Complicated. That's what's underneath the thumb. And nobody knows more about what's under your thumb. It's not Mick Jagger. It's Dr. Steve Shin, who's my guest right now. Dr. Shin, I want to ask you about this fascinating muscle. It almost reminds me, here's a clapper vision. We rode here in our cars, the 10 freeway, they continue to close for no apparent reason. I don't know who's running this city. But anyway, we're in a car. It has a chassis. It has four wheels. That's how we get around. But if you take that car to the beach, you're going to get stuck in the sand. If you take it where the gravel is, the wheels will spin. So some genius came up with the half track, which is what a tank uses to be able to get over sand and rocks, all kinds of terrain. I think we saw it first in World War I and then ultimately in World War II, this idea of a half track so that the ability to have the vehicle move over terrain that is bumpy and four wheels would not get the job done, to some extent, to hold a can of soda, to hold a hammer, to hold a baseball, to hold things that are of different dimensions and sizes so that we get a grip and can wrap our palm and fingers around it, you need a half track. You can't have four wheels on the car. You need the half track. Is that what the lumbricle is?
You know, that's a great analogy, Robbie. I never would have thought of that myself. You are brilliant.
Clapper vision.
Clapper vision. The lumbricle is just, and there are multiple lumbricals, obviously, and is just a very unique muscle. Coming from a tendon, going to a bone, like you said before, like the ring finger has different innervations, so do the lumbricals. Some of them are innervated by one nerve and the other is by another nerve. So it's like, wow, who thought of this? And why does it have to be that way? But that's what adds to the complexity in anatomy and function of the hand. Why we have five digits. So I don't know if a lot of people know, but the thumb is not a finger, right? So it's actually thumb and four fingers. So if anybody ever asks you how many fingers you have, you've got eight fingers and two thumbs. So, you know, a neat little fact for our listeners out there. Back to the lumbricle. Yeah, a fascinating muscle. It allows us to, you know, bend certain joints and straighten out the other ones. So for example, you bring your fingers down and you kind of form, your knuckles at 90 degrees, but your fingers are straight. Lumbricals kind of help do that. There are other muscles that do that as well. It's just amazing that the almighty being who designed our hand designed in such a way where we can have such coordination with each of our fingers, each of our joints, 27 bones, right? It's absolutely amazing.
I want to play a soundbite from 1968 when Johnny Bench was a rookie. I want you to listen to what injuries were like before we had people like Reinhold helping us with Arthrex to make better equipment. He missed his rookie year, Johnny Bench, because of five stitches that he needed in his thumb. Now you may not even use stitch. You may use crazy glue, Durabond, on this finger. Listen to this.
This is Gary Nolan, the youngest pitcher in Major League Baseball today, and standing next to him, Johnny Bench, the youngest catcher in Major League Baseball today, I think. And they formed the youngest battery in Major League Baseball last year. And then at the close of the season, Johnny got an injury, and I think you split your thumb. Isn't that right, John?
Yes, I required five stitches. It happened in the third game before the end of the season.
So you missed qualifying for Rookie of the Year honors, if I'm correct on that. So this year you might qualify again.
Yes, you are, but I think I'd rather have a pennant.
By the way, he got Rookie of the Year that year, so it was all good. Here's just a fun fact I'd love you to teach us about. If you look at the back of your hand, your forearm, there's hair. But when Johnny Bench is talking about he split his thumb, he's talking about the palm side of his thumb, and he had the stitches put in. Two questions I want to ask you. One, why can you not grow hair on the palm of your hand? and the pulp of your fingers? And what has improved in terms of splitting the skin that required him to be out? How long would he be out if he needed five stitches, the equivalent injury, in 2020?
Great questions. So the first one, the hair question, obviously, hairs grow from follicles, and we don't have that on the palm side. Why don't we have that on the palm side? Because that will get in the way of our feeling things, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why any kind of injury or a cut, like Johnny Bench had on the palm side, would be very, very difficult for us to feel things, to pinch, to grip a baseball. And so because the hair would get in the way, again, our great designer, made sure that we didn't have hair on the palm side. So that's why we have hair on the other side instead. So we don't have the cells in the skin that would make the hair on the palm
is
side.
Is the skin thicker? Is the epidermis and dermis? Let's go deep into one of your surgeries. You take a scalpel and you make an incision on the back of someone's hand. That skin is different than when you make an incision on the palm. And in patients who have a crippling disease called Dupuytren's contracture, what was his name, McCash? He came up with the idea that you don't even have to put stitches in there. Just leave it open and it'll granulate and heal on its own.
Right, exactly. So Dupuytren's contracture is actually something I did some research on when I was in training. And it is a genetic disease. People from Northern Europe, Eastern Europe have this predisposition to developing it. Their fingers start curling down and they can't straighten them out. And it can be very debilitating when it gets bad. So yes, the skin on the palm side is definitely thicker with this disease called Dupuytren's disease or Dupuytren's contracture. There's a layer of tissue right below the skin called your fascia, and that's above the tendons though, and that gets real thick. And that's what we take out when we do the surgery, or that's what we try to get to rupture on purpose with this enzyme. But I won't get into too many details about that. But yeah, definitely the skin on the palm side is thicker than the skin on the backside.
Okay, I'm talking to the great Dr. Steve Shin, who now is a part of Cedars-Sinai, and it's just a true pleasure to have him. I think I'm going to open up the clinic. We'll take some calls. The number is 877-710-ESPN. I also need to talk about some food. You've had omelets in your life. You put jelly on them. You can put salsa on them. But have you ever put deli mustard on an omelet? Why would you want to put deli mustard on an omelet? Because where I come from, one of the greatest omelets you can have in your life is a salami omelet. Have you ever put salami, bacon, everybody knows, ham, everybody, steak and eggs even. It's a next level experience to have salami and eggs because then you get to use deli mustard. My mouth is watering already, but I'm going to tell you where I ate this week and had the best salami omelet I've ever had. Because I got to put the Jewish deli mustard. Oh my God, it was unbelievable. We'll get into that. Let's take some calls. I don't have that much time. We'll take one call. Let's go to Chris in Duarte. I would have hung up a long time ago, Chris. I can't believe you're hanging on the line this long.
Hey, Dr. Klepper.
What do you do for a living, Chris?
What's that?
What do you do for a living?
Oh, I drive an armored truck to deliver money. I actually pick up money. I picked up money from Cedars before.
Wow, an armored truck with all that money. That's unbelievable. They should make a movie about you.
They have made a few movies.
I know. Some of them are the best. I love those movies where they rob the bank and they pretend to be someone like you. It's fantastic. What did your father do for a living?
Actually, my father was a construction glazer. He installed glass. And when I was 18, I worked underneath him, and we worked on Cedars. We did that 16-story building, that first one.
1976?
Yes, 1976.
Wow.
I was 18.
So I'm walking around on the floors that you actually built with your own hands?
Yes, sir. Well, I was on the inside. I wasn't hanging on the outside. I was handing the glass from the inside.
Now, how come you didn't stay in that business? Why didn't you stay in construction? Why did you end up going into the truck?
Well, at that time, it was hard to get jobs.
Got it.
After you finish a job, you have to look for another one, and I wanted something more stable, so made a little less money, but I knew I had a check coming in every week.
God bless you, Chris. Chris, are you a Laker fan?
Yes, I am.
What did Kobe mean to you?
He meant so much. Is just basically his hard work ethic that just stood out above everyone else's, and his love for the game, his passion,
right?
Children, the whole gamma, you know.
Yep, I agree with you. I agree with you. It's so hard for me to go to Staples Center to watch games now because he built that house.
We actually, our company used the pilot that
died in the crash.
In the helicopter to take us from Long Beach to Catalina to deliver money. So
Chris,
we knew the guy.
Chris, I already feel like you're part of my family. So tell me what I can do to help you. What did you hurt?
I got a rotator cuff, massive, complete tear.
All right, so let me tell you something. I want to trademark the term agercise, which means you exercise differently based on your age. But a corollary to that, Chris, is that you actually treat the same diagnosis differently depending on whether you have a rotator cuff tear and you're 18, 38, or 64. You're 64. The key word in your MRI, Chris, is does the tear have associated with it the word atrophy? Do you have your MRI in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Read me the impression and go slow so I can use clapper vision. You know what clapper vision is?
Yes, I do.
All right. Thanks for listening.
I listen to you on the way to the beach every Saturday surfing. That's how I got to find out.
All right. Let's go quick because I only have a few minutes.
Okay. It says massive, complete, supraspinatus, and anterior intraspinatus.
Right.
Tendon tears with mild muscle atrophy.
There you go. That's the key word. Mild muscle atrophy. Are you ready for a clapper vision?
Yes, sir.
You know who Bill Belichick is?
Yes, I do.
That guy loves in freezing cold weather. The number one thing he'll wear is a hooded sweatshirt, right? So his right and left ear are covered by the hood, and the top of his head is covered by the hood, correct? That's a hoodie.
Right.
His face is the cartilage of the ball and socket joint of your shoulder. That beautiful punim, as we say in Yiddish, that Bill Belichick has. That face is the cartilage. But the hooded sweatshirt is the hood that covers the top of the arm bone, the humerus, with muscles. That's what the rotator cuff is. Bill Belichick, you and I, Chris, ripped the hood, just the top that covers his hair on top of his head. Not his ears on either side, just the top of it. That's the supraspinatus covering of the ball and socket joint. But when we ripped his hood, we didn't rip it off completely so it flew in the wind and it's not there anymore. We actually unwrapped it like opening up a sardine can. The material is still there. It didn't get ripped off completely. We can now use thread and a needle to actually sew that defect of the top of the hood back to the other sides that cover his ears. We can repair his hooded sweatshirt. We don't have to get him a new hooded sweatshirt. That's what mild atrophy means. So, Chris, you're going to need surgery. Not, in my opinion, arthroscopic, by the way. I'm old school. For a massive tear that you've got, I like to still open them with a small incision. Do not let them give you cortisone shots or cockamamie stem cells or PRP. There's no hair coming back on top of my head. There's no shampoo that's going to work. So don't let them talk you into that. But it's not an emergency, but there is a clock ticking because the longer you wait to fix it, the more that atrophy that can take place. So you live in Duarte. You'll need to find someone good who can do it. And if not, then you're going to come to Cedars and I'll take care of you. But that's what has to happen with what you've just described. Capiche?
Capiche. But he recommended a reverse replacement.
At 64, the fact that there's mild atrophy, no. If it was my shoulder, and they're entitled to their opinion, Chris, it's a free country. In my opinion, I would try and fix that. Okay?
Oh,
that's my opinion.
Great.
So,
great news.
All right, I want you to do me a favor. I just helped you. You're a total stranger, although I told you, you feel like family already. I need you to find a total stranger today. Do something nice for them. That's how you'll be helping me.
I sure will. Thank you so much.
All right, God bless you. Have a good day.
You too.
All right, we'll take a break. The great Steve Paulette in the house, making us all sound good. Coming up next, I'm going to tell some stories, and I'm going to hold Dr. Shin hostage. I've got callers. Ron and Steve, hang on the line. I'll get to you. The number is 877-710-ESPN. What a wonderful day we're having already, Dr. Steve Shin, here on the Weekend Warriors Show on 710 ESPN.